Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them potato.
The Republican fight over immigration is getting real, and American universities are divided over racism and free speech. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Leon Krause, news anchor for Univision's Los Angeles affiliate KMEX. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest this week is Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. Welcome to all of you. Well, so a long-anticipated event in the Republican primary finally happened this week. Other candidates have started attacking Marco Rubio over his shifting record on immigration. Rubio, of course, was one of the Gang of Eight senators behind the comprehensive immigration reform bill that passed the Senate in 2013 and would have created a path to citizenship for unauthorized immigrants. That bill, of course, failed in the House. Rubio has changed his mind. He now opposes a comprehensive approach. And Ted Cruz attacked him this week on conservative talk radio, saying that Rubio had repeatedly opposed amendments to the comprehensive bill that would have made it better, that would have increased border security and other enforcement. Donald Trump, as usual, has been less subtle in his attacks on Marco Rubio over this issue. He just says Rubio's for more immigration because he's Hispanic. Rich, so you wrote about this week. This is an issue that has energized the Republican base. Is this the issue that's going to stop Marco Rubio from being the Republican nominee?
I don't think it'll necessarily stop him. The history is you can have an issue where you're really heterodox and that really gets people angry at you and still get nominated. It's true of Mitt Romney on health care last time around. It's true with John McCain on immigration in 2008. But this is a big vulnerability. Now, Rubio has been hitting back against Ted Cruz saying, well, you try to amend my bill to even further increase levels of legal immigration by increasing H-1B visas several times over, and you didn't oppose a path to legalization. You opposed a path to citizenship, but not to legalization. And I think Rubio has points there, but it's still, you're kind of in a bizarre position if you're attacking someone else for not opposing your own signature legislation with enough zeal and clarity. So Rubio has shown an amazing ability to talk himself out of any tight spot, and this will be the most challenging tight spot yet.
Leon, I think there's an interesting asymmetry here around this. I mean, this distinction about, you know, whether a path to citizenship versus a path to some sort of non-citizenship legal status. This is something that immigration advocates care deeply about, and wanting a path to citizenship and not having second-class status. But it's not clear to me that there's a flip side to that on the side with the opponents to immigration, where I think there's a sense that, you know, if you let somebody be in the country legally, they will at some point in the future figure out a way to stay and be a citizen and whatnot. And so is this distinction that, you know, Ted Cruz and Ben Carson are relying on, saying, you know, let them stay here, but don't let them be citizens, is that something that really appeals to anybody?
I think that in the end it makes no difference. I mean, what's interesting to me is that this is bad policy from the Republican Party and bad politics for the Republican Party. Even considering the possibility of deporting 11 million people, something that would cost, as we know, $600 billion, is absurd. And then you have the politics of it, Josh. I mean, what Republicans needed for 2016 was a primary season as moderate as possible on this issue of immigration. That's why Bush seemed like an ideal candidate. And instead you have now, we are discussing this issue this way, and you have Donald Trump who makes Tom Tancredo look reasonable. So that's what I think. The fact is Republicans don't need just a solid year, but a great year in 2016 with Hispanics if they want to take back the White House. And Romney's well-known self-deportation argument, as we know, brought his Latino share down to 27%. Republicans need at least 40%. I don't think they'll get there after the summer of Trump.
Rich, do you think that analysis is right? Because I feel like, you know, this is certainly what Republican establishment figures in Washington have said, but those Republican establishment figures also support a more relaxed immigration policy on the merits, and it doesn't seem like you're going to be able to get out of this field a policy that's you know, appealing to Hispanics. So then you have the question of, well, maybe you do need to appeal to the Donald Trump supporters, and Republicans, as far as I can see, have failed on both sides. They haven't pleased people who want higher levels of immigration, nor have they convinced opponents of immigration that they're in their camp.
Yeah, I'd say a couple things. One, obviously you shouldn't be going out and just deliberately trying to insult an entire class of people the way Donald Trump has repeatedly done. That's obviously bad politics. But I don't think a reasonable immigration policy need be a deal breaker for Latino voters if it is sold in the context of a party that has a more working class message generally, because the new low-skilled immigrants and the current the situation we have is we're largely importing low-skilled immigrants. They compete against low-skilled workers who are both native and immigrant. It's not in their interest to have this constant new supply of labor coming in. Now, if you sell it in those terms, I think you can get a hearing if you also have an economic agenda that appeals to working-class people of all races and classes. But that's a little tricky. And, you know, the guy who has the most populist appeal, Donald Trump, is being most offensive to Latinos. And someone like Jeb Bush has zero populist appeal. So I think you're kind of right that the twain is not meeting there.
Can I answer your fundamental question, which is, does this take Marco Rubio out of the running?
Yes.
In a primary? And the answer is no, but it does take him out of the running forever being president, this debate, because the only way Republicans have been able to win the elections that they have is that they've been able, for the presidency, is that they've been able to siphon off a portion of traditionally Democratic voters. George W. Bush, who was governor of my home state, Texas, was able to win, you know, nearly 30% of Latino voters. You can't really do that if you have a primary like this, where to win it, you have to essentially not just say that you don't support comprehensive immigration reform, but take some sort of stand that essentially says that you have a problem with them being here in the first place or bringing their family members. You know, there's a reason George W. Bush was called the compassionate conservative, because there was a way he was able to articulate and form out a position that didn't alienate those voters and convince them to support him in double digits. So, you know, when I read this morning in the Washington Post that you have Robert Costa, one of the best reporters on these issues in terms of conservative circles, saying that Republican donors are so terrified at this point of what's happening in terms of alienating the voters and giving them a chance at the presidency, they're talking about drafting Romney. Now, Costa is not, you know, some crank report. I mean, he has really good sourcing. So the fact that he's saying that he is hearing that people are seriously trying to figure out how to draft Romney kind of answers the question about how confident, you know, Republicans are feeling about what this issue is doing to the party.
Yeah, Josh, although I would say, yes, go ahead, Leon.
No, to Rich's point, the problem for me is that Republicans simply can't defend reasonable positions on immigration during the primaries. Rubio is quite reasonable on immigration. I like his positions on immigration as
which
as
positions? What day of the week is it?
Well, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. His original positions on immigration, and even nowadays, his rhetoric when it comes to being compassionate and the way he defended the Gang of Eight proposal, I mean, quite reasonable if you read his whole history and especially the first part of his term in the Senate. But that reasonable position might cost him the nomination, and that's a drama among Republicans now on immigration.
Well, yeah, but I think going back to something Rich said earlier, that for Republicans to do better among Hispanics is not purely about immigration. When you poll Hispanics on the question of should we have a larger government providing more services or a smaller government providing fewer services, they say by a wide margin, larger government, more services.
Can I say it wasn't, but I would argue it probably is more so now.
But going back to George Bush had a position that was friendly on immigration, but George Bush was also relatively a big government conservative.
Yes.
Who was not anti-spending, who expanded the Medicare prescription drug benefit. And so if you were coming up with a suite of policies to endear the Republican Party to minority groups, including Hispanics, you might follow the Bush model. But I think that Bush model is unacceptable to the base, not just on immigration, but probably even more so on the spending stuff. So I just feel like that's something can't bridge.
But how would you then explain Romney's dismal numbers with Hispanics?
Well, I think Romney's dismal numbers with Hispanics were because he was to the right of Bush on both immigration and on economic issues.
But what I was trying to get at, Josh, and the reason I kind of challenged the premise of that, the way those numbers laid out, is on paper they make sense, and here's how they don't in the larger scheme of things. I'm guessing, and I'm interested to see how this plays out, is when I look at my own family, for instance, there are plenty of issues they vote on. When things start being more stressed about race in America, then it elevates their thinking about those issues. And that was something that I saw happen in the last year, where there, you know, I had family members who said, I never would have walked into a voting booth thinking about police brutality. I do now. And so the more Trump talks, I think the worse it gets for them, because I think that actually elevates the issue of immigration as being a number one, number two, and possibly number three issue for some Latino voters in a way it wouldn't have been in previous elections.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can we talk a little bit about Ted Cruz?
Do we have to?
Well, no, it's funny because, I mean, well, for one thing, Donald Trump said, you know, well, Marco Rubio is for more immigration because he's Hispanic. But Ted Cruz, of course, is also Hispanic and is getting well to
and Marco Canadian. Don't forget Canadian.
Hispanic and Canadian. He contains multitudes. So Cruz has this sort of interesting middle position on immigration where he's clearly to Marco Rubio's right and to the right of a lot of the Republican establishment, but not as far to the right as Donald Trump. He's not saying round them all up and deport them. And I'm wondering, Rich, do you think that's going to become a fault line in this campaign? Because Rubio's out there basically trying to say Ted Cruz is a squish on immigration, too. We're all squishes on immigration. I assume sooner or later Donald Trump is going to join in that chorus and say, yeah, you're all squishes on immigration except me. Is there really an interest in this sort of like roughly where National Review is, maybe where Ted Cruz is? Or is there sort of an ever rightward march on this issue in the party?
Well, the debate has definitely moved to the right, especially on legal immigration, because you look during the Gang of Eight bill, Ted Cruz was spouting sort of the typical conservative platitudes on this. I disdain legal immigration, illegal immigration, but I love legal immigration. And the assumption was that all legal immigration is good and we should have even more of it. And Trump has definitely moved that debate to the right, as you see now with Ted Cruz eschewing his former support for increased H-1B visas. I believe if he hasn't already, he's going to come out in favor of lower overall levels of immigration. And he's sounding like Jeff Sessions on the issue of how immigration interacts with the economy, saying it's important
That's
to focus
on— That's the conservative senator from Alabama who chairs the relevant committee in the Senate.
Yeah, on wages. I just don't see anyone else. I would be shocked if Ted Cruz ends up going all the way to the Trump, we have to deport everyone position, because that's obviously politically toxic. It is completely unsustainable on the merits. We have an immigration bureaucracy that can't even manage the current legal immigration system. If you know anyone who's trying to come here to this country and get a green card, it is a nightmare. And the idea that those people, if you give them more power, would suddenly be able to identify all illegal immigrants in the country and make no mistakes and never misidentify everyone and deport them in 2 years and then bring the terrific ones back is just crazy. It's completely crazy.
Let us know what you think about Republicans on immigration at kcrw.com/LRC, on our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, the controversy at Mizzou. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Leon Krause, news anchor for Univision's Los Angeles affiliate, KMEX. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast is also with us. One more thing on the debate. We talked about this sort of big immigration theme, but there was a lot of other stuff that happened at the debate, and John Kasich got very prickly, and if you watch the dial groups and the focus groups, they did not like him constantly interrupting and trying to talk. Having watched this debate and some of the people struggling in it, who's next out of the Republican field?
Well, can I say that I predict it won't be John Kasich, because John Kasich may not make a particular really likable presidential candidate. I think he'd make a hell of a VP ticket, because he's proven himself to be a great attack dog and to not have a problem with being seen as not likable. And I think if you pair him with someone who has less experience, is younger and more likable, perhaps a Rubio, I think that's actually a particularly lethal ticket that the GOP could mount.
Huh. Leon. What do you think?
I think Rand Paul, but I think the other question is when will Jeb Bush drop out of the race? I'm betting that he won't get to 2016. I think he's in real trouble even after this debate in which he was just a little bit better.
Well, and Rich, you're the most inside on this of all of us. What's your intel?
I don't know in terms of who's the next to drop out, because you have a number of these guys who are making the bet in Iowa, which is that we're just going to spend a lot of time here and we'll take off in the last 3 weeks. And why should I get out as long as I have a large capacity for embarrassment and I have enough money at least to take some flights around the country? And yeah, then you have another tranche of candidates who are banking the same thing in New Hampshire.
Well, from Iowa and New Hampshire to Missouri, it's been a tumultuous week on several university campuses. At Yale and Mizzou, there have been protests over racism and questions about rules for free speech on campus. And at Missouri, there have been resignations from two top administrators. At Yale, the proximate cause of the recent consternation was Halloween costumes. There was an email from administrators warning students against wearing offensive costumes and urging them to think deeply about who might be offended by what they might wear and why. There was then a response email from another administrator noting the importance of letting students choose freely and make mistakes and offend people and tell people that they're offended. And then there was outrage over that email. This story's been something of a Rorschach test. At least at Yale, a lot of the complaints from students have seemed really overwrought to a lot of people, including me, and you know, things like saying that students are losing sleep and can't eat because of the costume email. But I've been noticing a really big divide between white and non-white observers in the media that make me wonder if there's something I'm failing to relate here. So let's go around the table. What should we think about what we've been watching go on at college campuses this week? Kelly, do you want to start?
Sure. And for those who don't know, I'm an African-American woman, in case that's important to some of your listeners listening to this conversation. I don't really think that Missouri and Yale should be mentioned in the same breath in terms of seriousness, because I'm someone who believes that you have a right to make me uncomfortable in a free society. You don't have a right to create a hostile environment for me where I work or where I study. And I think the Missouri students made a compelling case that that's what was starting to happen with the swastikas and the feces and the response of some of the administration to it. And I don't know that the Yale students have made the same case yet. You know, we're all still waiting for more to come out. And you know, the other thing about being uncomfortable is that means that we're going to have conversations about where we disagree. And I think that's also where Yale hasn't made the same case as the students at Mizzou, which is when you saw the back and forth that was going on initially, at least on video, between some of the students and the administrators. That was not a civilized exchange of ideas. That was, you know, people saying, I've been treated unfairly.
This is at Yale.
This is at Yale.
Yeah.
And you don't have a right to respond in a way that's not of my liking, and I can shout you down and when you do it. And so that's, I just want to be careful. I feel that the only things that these two situations really have in common so far is that they're college campuses and students were upset. I don't know, again, that the case has been made at Yale that a hostile environment in its totality had been created and administrators should fail to do absolutely anything about it.
Rich, I know you've been writing about this week.
I think it's complete hysteria in both cases. The Yale is completely ridiculous, and Missouri is ridiculous as well. Now, there were allegedly a few instances of racial slurs. There was one confirmed incident where a drunk kid abused black students who were rehearsing a skit, I believe, for homecoming, and he was removed from campus, and disciplinary proceedings are underway, and the administration profusely apologized and said how seriously it took this and instituted a new regime of diversity training, and it wasn't enough. And they just called for this president's head pretty much because they knew they could. And the administration completely capitulated, even though no one has presented any evidence of what he in particular did wrong or what particular responsibility he bears for a few isolated incidents of hateful speech.
In Missouri, part of the concern, Rich, was that he only responded when he realized he was in trouble, and that he didn't respond initially when they tried to have conversations with him about it. That was my understanding of following the timeline. And so that was where part of the anger came from. But I have to share something that a friend of mine posted on Facebook that I thought was really telling and has really made me think a lot about, you know, who gets their, you know, who gets to actually get held accountable when people are upset about what they consider hostility, which is someone wrote on Facebook, Black linebackers matter. The point being that when push came to shove, Missouri responded because they were worried about their football status. That's what ultimately happened. And that's the reality of the country we're living in, which is when people see big money at stake, which football is, there's hardly a bigger industry in places like I come from, like Texas or Missouri. And that's fundamentally what they responded to. I don't think that people were sitting behind saying, we really have had a serious soul-searching conscience moment, come to Jesus moment on race. What they thought is, we can't afford to not have our football team play. And that's...
That's
certainly true. But what did the administration do that was so awful on race? I mean, protesters blocked the president's car for 15 minutes and he didn't talk to them. And then a couple days later, he abjectly apologized for not having talked to them. And then when they protested him outside another event, he came outside and they were badgering him with questions. He said, well, I'm not going to talk to you because whatever I say will be wrong. And they're like, oh, you won't talk to us. Look at this. This is awful. And then he finally answered their question, which was, what is systematic oppression? And he says it's when you don't think you have the equal opportunity that other people do. And then they screeched at him that he was blaming them because he used the word you for systematic oppression. These are just not reasonable people. And an administration worth its salt would have stood its ground and stood up to them.
I just think it's so hard to tell from a distance with right. the limited information we have who's being reasonable about what. I mean, I look at the football thing in two ways. I don't love the outsized power that football and basketball teams have on,
yeah. over the rest of us.
Well, and the financial role they play in universities. But on the other hand, like, football teams are not usually bastions of left-wing activism on college right. campuses. And this is also a signal to me that the discontent at Missouri went beyond sort of the usual set of campus radicals
yes.
who will complain all the time about everything. And, you know, often I was a student at Harvard when Larry Summers' presidency was sort of imploding there. And there was all the national news coverage about, you know, big hot-button national issues. But then there was also, like, he really annoyed the law school faculty by trying to move their campus. And then all these other ham-fisted things of no particular national importance, but were real problems in his presidency that weren't really obvious from the outside. So I wonder, here in Missouri, when sort of this administration crumbled, what else was happening behind the scenes? And were there a lot of reasons that people were not inclined to raise their hands and say, this guy should stick
we'll
around?
Him.
Maybe
now,
things unrelated to this.
I'm so glad you said that, because I do agree that we can't look at this in a vacuum. I think the context of the ghost of Ferguson, right? And that's really, I'm sure that beyond the timelines that Rich and I have both read or covered, there is a lot going back to how people perceive someone, whether or not they're willing to give them a pass. And that's just a fact on race. I'm just going to say this flat out. I've had people say to me, I know that person's a misogynist in the media industry. And I say, that's news to me because he gave me a really big break in my career. You know, I know this person has issues with people of color. That's news to me. This individual was really kind to me. But people are going from their own experiences, and that's how they decide if they give someone the benefit of the doubt or not. I'm sorry, I'm inclined to agree with you that when a football team decides we're not giving this guy the benefit of the doubt anymore, and they've probably been treated a lot better than, you know, some of the other people on campus, it raises a question. My larger takeaway, though, from all of this, even though I made the whole joke about black linebackers matter, is this. You know, we talk about, it's written about a lot, how little power people of color allegedly have in this country. And for me, this was a wake-up call that actually we have the biggest amount of power in certain industries. I mean, we are the most prevalent workers in two of the biggest money-making industries in this country, National Football League and the NBA. And yet you go back and you take a look, and basketball players barely gave to any of the presidential candidates in the last election cycle. They have certainly never created a super PAC. And so it starts making me question that if we really want to change things in society, why isn't our community leveraging our power in more significant ways? Because we actually have the capacity to do so. And the Mizzou players showed that.
Leon, I want to get you in on this. What have you thought this week watching this?
Well, I know I'm on the left today, but I tend to agree with Rich on this issue. I mean, look, I'm completely aware that the most urgent issue here is the debate over racial tension in America. But I also think it's crucial that we talk about the importance of defending free speech and resisting political correctness. It's impossible yeah. for me, at least, to agree with a student who yells shut up, or another one who says
agreed.
I don't want to debate. I mean, shut up is not a liberal argument, and it's not an argument in general, right? So that
Amen.
Is not what college life is about, or life in a free liberal democracy. And I also think that political correctness has a very dark side, and we should be very, very careful not to fall into it.
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot of overreach here, but I think there's also been underreach in certain places. I think colleges need to learn a little bit from the real world, but I think there are some things the real world can learn from colleges here. Like, when you go back and read the original email from the Yale administrators about the costumes. It's reflective of a hypersensitivity, but on the other hand, the individual pieces of the advice in the costume email were actually good advice that a lot of people don't pay heed to. And, like, you know, if you can just advising people to think a little bit about whether what they're about to do is going to make somebody feel bad or feel offended. I mean, you can just think of that as politeness. You don't have to think of it as political correctness or a broader thing. And I think it would be I don't think we want to live in an environment of hypersensitivity, but I think it would do people well to think a little bit more about how their actions make other people feel and just to be a little bit more sensitive about that. And I think there is a middle ground. Yeah,
some of it is a different argot for just talking about good manners, but a lot of it is just completely hysterical and irrational. And this notion of safety has become so nefarious on campus, which is that your safety is threatened if you hear an idea you disagree with or hear speech that you disagree with. And the idea that these kids at Missouri, the protesters, would somehow be threatened by a very well-mannered Asian-American photographer who wanted to take a picture of what was going on to record it for history and for ESPN would get shoved around and said you're threatening them just because you want to take a picture of them is absolutely crazy, and every reasonable person needs to say so.
Well, I'm probably going to say words that you'll rarely hear, Rich, which is you and President Obama are in agreement on something, because he did say a few months ago that we need to stop this idea on college campuses that because someone makes you uncomfortable, they're doing something wrong. He said the purpose of going to college is to be uncomfortable
in his favor.
Because of ideas.
In his favor, if I remember. Yeah.
Well, on that note of bipartisan agreement, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Leon, what's on your mind?
Thank you. So I'll go back to the election. If Marco Rubio wins the Republican nomination, and I think that's quite likely, then the most important question facing the Democrats will be this one. How is Julian, I call him Julian, you see, I've become Americanized, Julian Castro's Spanish doing? Because if Rubio wins, I think there's just no way that Castro won't be the Democratic VP nominee. And even though the Hispanic community is far from monolithic and being Cuban is very, very different than being Mexican, Rubio's perfect Spanish will raise an interesting question, which is this. Will Latinos vote for someone just because he speaks their language fluently? I think the answer is no, but the Democrats can't risk it. That's why they better make sure that Julian Castro, is taking his Espanol seriously.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I want to salute my friend Dave Tewin, who passed away last week. He was an extraordinary Blythe spirit, a dedicated Steelers fan, a successful journalist, and above all, a devoted husband and father. He fought intestinal cancer for 9 years, tooth and nail, with grace and dignity. If anyone deserved to prevail, he did. Dave, rest in peace.
Kelly Goff, what's on your mind?
Well, in an age of the racial inequality and tension that we're dealing with right now, I think it's an American tragedy, not just that it exists, but that we have so much concentrated African-American wealth in this country in the form of the NBA and the NFL, and we are not seeing more of the people in those industries take a leadership role and open their checkbooks to make social change. Tweeting's great. Supporting things financially is even more important.
For my rant, one of the remarkable claims in the debate this week, Carly Fiorina saying again that she can reduce the tax code all the way down to 3 pages from the several thousand it is now. I looked into the 3-page plan that she posted on Facebook, and the thing is, it's not a tax code. It's a plan to replace one of 11 parts of the tax code, would still leave you with well over 1,000 pages, and omits lots of important rules that are necessary so that, for example, people can't pay their employees in food instead of cash and therefore avoid tax on it entirely. So yeah, taxes are complicated. They could be a lot simpler. They can't be simplified all the way to 3 pages. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Kelly Goff, and Leon Krause. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Hannah Tayson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.